The message you are about to hear is brought to you by Art Bradick. And now, Mr. Bradick.
Turn over to John 2. John 2, and we'll begin this message today, because today is the last great day. And Jesus Christ Himself called it a great day. And I believe He called it a great day, and it is a great day because of all it represents. And I think it is this way in part because God seems to save the best for last. Now, when our children were little, I had to learn this lesson. We had a problem. It was vegetables. And the kids would eat the things they liked best first, and then they would leave the things they didn't like for last. And so dinner would drag on and on and on. And then there would be threats that would have to come. And so finally, after enough of these kinds of dinners, I finally learned this principle that I believe is one of God's. And that is, we simply had the children eat the vegetables first. And then they could eat with enjoyment the rest of their meal. And then finally, at the end, would come dessert. And we would save the best for last. And it just changed the whole complex of our dinner. So, something I forgot here, please forgive me. I think everyone would probably have some thanks to give at this feast. And I'm going to thank Dennis, of course, for all that he gave. Forgot to do this, I was so focused on my message. But Dennis has made so much of this feast possible, and so many of us maybe wouldn't even be able to have come. Wouldn't even be able to enjoy half of what we've been able to enjoy without his help, his tremendous generosity. And I certainly want to thank you for all those late night discussions, Dennis, in which you didn't understand, but in our mind, we know we're not going to prevail. We just think we're going to prevail if we get him to listen. And also Mr. Cobb, without which we probably wouldn't even have a church, much less a feast. And his untiring work behind the scenes in planning and washing dishes and physical things that he did too. So thank all of you. But I do realize this, I could go to every single one and you would have someone you want to thank personally, because we've given, each one of us has given so much to one another. So anyway, here we are at the feast today and celebrating this last great day. And it is a very great day. And there is a kind of order to things, if you'll notice. That is, God seems to do things a certain way according to order. And so you notice he says what about those who are last? They are first. And he has the Sabbath, the crowning day of the week, is the one that comes last. Because he saves the best for last. That's the way our God is. It's a principle of his. And here we are in John 2 here, and we're talking about a story about a marriage supper that took place in Cana, a very small city. And Christ and his disciples were called to the wedding. And during the wedding, they ran out of wine, and Jesus' mother called him over and asked him to do something about it. And so Jesus told the servants to bring over these pots and fill them with water and draw out of the water and give to the governor of the feast. And when he drank of the wine, the water changed into wine. The governor said, "This is really good wine." Chapter 2 of John, in verse 9. When the ruler of the feast had tasted the water that was made wine, and knew not from where it came, but the servants which drew the water, they knew, why, the governor of the feast called the bridegroom, and he said unto him, "Every man at the beginning does set forth good wine, and when men have well drunk, then that which is worse. But you have kept the good wine until now." Yes, he kept the good wine until later. We can see so much in this tremendous miracle. It was the first miracle that Christ performed. And he did it in a remote location. He did it without a lot of fanfare. But we can learn some lessons from this. One is that he performs even little miracles for little needs that are ours. It doesn't have to be something great and big. This was just to save these people some embarrassment. But he was concerned enough to do a miracle for them. And you can also see that God is generous Why, he made 6 firkins of wine at this marriage supper. This is, at minimum, would be 120 gallons of wine. But you also see that when God does something, when he produces something, it is of the highest quality. But we also see this one other significant point, and that is this, that he seems to save the best for last. He could have made this wine exactly the same kind of wine that the other wine was. He could have made it Gallo. He could have made it any kind of wine. He could have made it whatever he wanted, but he made it the finest quality. Think for a minute. If somebody really brought you a glass of wine and you tasted it and it was really good, you'd say, wow, this is good wine. And you'd leave it at that. Oh no, this wine was really good. So good that he called the groom over and said, hey, I got to talk to you about this. It's so good. No, he saves the best for last. And I think we just barely see through the crack the light of what this day means and how great it's going to be, because he saves the best for last. John 7, a couple of chapters over. If you'll move there with me. That's what this feast is all about. The last day. The best day. A great day. I believe the greatest of God's holy days. That shows probably the greatest part of his plan. Jesus Christ said the day was great. John 7, verse 37. John 7, verse 37. In the last day, that great day of the feast, Jesus stood and cried, saying, if any man thirst, let him come to me and drink. And so this day is called by our Savior great. And the word he uses is megas, and that means exceedingly great. Now in English, when we use this word, it means chief or favorite or preeminent. It means excellent in nature, large in number, beyond the ordinary, and so on. When you and I talk today in modern parlance, we might use the word mega bucks. It means you got a lot of bucks. And that's a word that comes from this one that Jesus Christ used. It means large, very large. But there's something else. The Greek word megas includes something else. When you look it up in Strong's, you'll find that you're referred to 2 other words. And those words are one, megistos or megistos, and it means extraordinarily great. But get this, it also refers you to another word that is called yakas. Y-A-C-H-A-S, adds a whole other dimension. You know what that word means? To enroll by pedigree, to number by generation or genealogy. This day is megas. It's great, exceedingly large, but it also implies a time when God is going to enroll, or he's going to number people, a large number of people, by their genealogies. Matthew 12. Do you see it? It's going to be such a great day. Exceedingly large numbers are going to be involved. And he's going to number them according to their genealogies. Yes? There's coming a time that we have just celebrated of 1,000 years of God's reign. And it says in, of course, Revelation, it says that the rest of the dead lived not until the 1,000 years were finished. But when those 1,000 years are finished, the rest of all the dead are going to be raised, and they're going to be raised, and they're going to be numbered according to their different generations. And it's talked about here by Jesus Christ in Matthew 12, and verse 41. The men of Nineveh shall rise in judgment with this generation, and they'll condemn it, because they repented at the preaching of Jonas. And behold, a greater than Jonas is here. The queen of the south will rise up in the judgment with this generation and shall condemn it, for she came from the uttermost parts of the earth to hear the wisdom of Solomon. And behold, a greater than Solomon is here. What a fantastic time that's going to be. And here we have generations, of course, sort of jabbing the other ones. You know, well, we wouldn't have done it the way you did it. You can kind of imagine that going on as we jab and joke with one another sometimes. But anyway, it's a time when the people of Sodom and Gomorrah are going to be alive again. It's a time when Lamech, when Adam, when Uriah the Hittite, if you will, all of those people who were in the Tower of Babel and had their language changed. All of those people who went through the flood, all of those Israelites who came out of Egypt and who went through the Red Sea, all of those Israelites who existed, the 5,000 that Christ fed, all of these people that went through so much, the little band that followed David, all of them are going to rise at the same time. And they're going to have a story to tell. And they are going to have some pretty interesting stories. And this book is just the mere outline of all of the millions and millions and millions of lives and all those things that have gone on. All of the people in the Middle Ages, all of the people who went through the Crusades, Christopher Columbus, if you will. Yes, Hitler, Stalin, Mussolini, all of those men will be there too, but also will be Mozart, also will be Sir Isaac Newton, also will be so many of the greats and wonderful people who've contributed to the earth. Going to be great, a great day. Going to be big in numbers. It's going to be big in the preparation that's going to be required for all of this to take place. It's going to be big in how many people are going to be able to be helped. And it's going to be big because of all the pain and all the suffering that has existed throughout this entire world's history that's going to finally be able to be alleviated. Yes, it's going to be very great. I think it will be a time that will be recognized as great, even as eternity unfolds itself. Don't you think that we'll look back to this time that it represents, that this day represents, and always term it great? It is going to be magnificent, when a time when all that is temporary will be done away, and there will only be the permanent. Now, I ask you today to think about this first. In terms of the vast sizes of population that are going to exist at this time. I guess we have about 6 billion people today that are alive on the earth. And you think about it, a million is a lot of anything, isn't it, if you started counting a million. But think about 1,000 million. Millions are very much. Think of the billions of people that are alive today, and then think of the billions of people that have existed from the very beginning of time, and having all of those people, so many that there are. And it said that Israel would be like the sand of the sea, and Israel would be like the stars of the sky. That's a lot, isn't it? A lot of people. But then add in Japan, add in China, add in all of those. When you start counting up Israel, you've got to look at Canada, you've got to look at the United States, you've got to look at Western Europe, you've got to look at Australia, and all of the people who don't even know who they are, all of those people raised with all of the other people raised throughout the entire world, throughout all history. We're talking about an incredible number of people. That's going to be big, isn't it? You imagine a resurrection like that? And could you imagine knowing when it was going to occur? Can you imagine all of the people around the earth coming to where Christ was before this event happens to celebrate this day? I bet you anything, it's going to, of course, happen on the last day of the feast, on the last day of the 7,000 years. And everyone will come and celebrate, and all humanity will be there for this event, and they'll watch it take place. I think it's going to be something so awesome, there's not going to be much in the way of celebration, not much in the way of anything that has ever happened on this earth that could ever match this vast number of people being resurrected and then numbered according to their generations, according to their races and genealogy. And then I ask you to think for a moment, how great is going to be the preparation for this? How great would it be to make the provisions necessary for all of these people, all raised at one time? I don't think that they're going to be raised with anything more than themselves. They're going to need clothing, aren't they? They're going to be raised from a long, century-long sleep. They're going to need breakfast. They're going to need food. They're going to need clothing. They're going to need a place of shelter. And God, who is our provider, will provide these things. They will have to be provided for these people. Now, what do you do with so many people? Do you have any grasp of the kind of effort it will be to provide for all these people? I think Mr. Armstrong said this better than anyone else who I've ever read or ever talked to before. And he writes this in Tomorrow, What Will It Be Like? Today, he says, the greatest and most awesome problem of all is the population explosion. Growing populations in all nations are rapidly outstripping the ability of the world to sustain them. And the areas of the greatest rise in population are the underdeveloped parts of the world, the have-not nations of poverty, illiteracy, disease, superstition. Remember, he says, not more than 10% of the Earth's surface is tillable or arable land. And now the latest UN figures indicate the world will double in population in just 35 short years. And the population has just grown dramatically, hasn't it? Remember, just a while back it was 5 billion, and now it's 6. But God has a solution, and how simple it is. Simply make most of the earth cultivatable. Reduce the bare, snow-swept, craggy mountains. Raise up some of the deep, arid desert valleys. Change the world weather patterns. Make all the deserts green and fertile. Open up huge slices of the earth like the Kalahari Desert, Lake Chad Basin in the Sahara in Africa, the Gobi Desert in Asia, and the Great American Deserts. Make green and verdant the vast waste of the Mongolia, Siberia, Saudi Arabia, and many of the western states in the U.S. Thaw out the deep ice packs and snowdrifts, the permafrost and tundra from the vast, almost limitless expanses of Antarctica, North America, Greenland, Northern Europe, and Siberia. Make level the awesome Paraminat, the huge giant Himalayas, the Atlas, Taurus, Pyrenees, Rockies, Sierras, and level the immense sweep of the Andes and all of these other forbidding, towering, virtually uninhabitable mountains of the earth. Then provide good, gentle rainfall in the right balance, just at the right season, and what happens? Multiple millions of acres of unbelievably fertile, productive, wonderful farmland suddenly becomes available. Yes, people have talked about how could this ever happen, that you could have such a vast population rise up and take place, be taken care of. But I'll say this. It wasn't until I went to visit my daughter and see her graduate in Texas that I really captured a vision of how much land we have here. And just driving out the 10 and going through Arizona and then New Mexico and then into Texas. Why, in Texas, you can see vast miles and miles and miles of nothing. And then here's a little city clustered somewhere, and you sort of drive through it, and then you go on again, hour after hour after hour. And there are vast lands that can be used and will be used, and God will miraculously shake the earth, and He will bring the mountains down, and He'll bring the valleys up. And He talks about this over in Isaiah 41. Let's go over there for an inspiring look at the Scripture, what God promises us. Isaiah 41. We will first unite the world under His government, and we'll use miracles to change the earth. And then we'll also use mankind to begin to develop the earth that has been changed. But He's going to break loose, He says, the fountains that are underneath, and they're going to spring forth with crystal clear, beautiful drinking water. And He's going to make the deserts bloom. Isaiah 41 and verse 14 says this, "Fear not, you worm Jacob, and you men of Israel. I'm going to help you, says the Lord, and your Redeemer, the Holy One of Israel. Behold, I'll make you a new and sharp threshing instrument having teeth, and you'll thresh the mountains, and you'll beat them small, and you'll make the hills as chaff, and you'll fan them, and the wind shall carry them away, and the whirlwind shall scatter them. And then you'll rejoice in the Lord, and you'll glory in the Holy One of Israel, when the poor and the needy seek water, and there is none, and their tongue fails for thirst, I, the Lord, will hear them. I, the God of Israel, will not forsake them. I'll open rivers in the high places and fountains in the midst of the valleys. I'll make the wilderness a pool of water, and the dry land springs of water. And I'll plant in the wilderness the cedar, the shittah tree, the myrtle, and the oil tree. And I'll set in the desert the fir tree and the pine and the box tree together, that they may see and know and consider and understand together that the hand of the Lord has done this and that the Holy One of Israel has created it." Let's move over to Isaiah 35 for another brief scripture that sort of amplifies this and expands on it. Time is coming when God is going to change the face of the earth to feed, to nourish his people. And so in Isaiah 35 and verse 6, it says, "And then shall the lame man leap as a hart, and the tongue of the dumb sing. For in the wilderness shall waters break out, and streams in the desert. And the parched ground shall become a pool, and the thirsty land springs of water. In the habitation of dragons," or jackals that is, "where each lay shall be a grass with reeds and with rushes." It's going to be a verdant paradise. That's what God is going to create here. And the mountains and the hills are going to become rich farmland. And the deserts and the deserts are going to, and the valleys and deserts are going to bloom. But I want us to understand, God is going to do all of this, but it is just setting the foundation to prepare for a people that are going to be raised up 1,000 years later. And mankind will then have to build cities. He will have to build manufacturing plants. There are going to have to be educational centers and so on, and programs, roads to have to be built in order to transport things, to prepare an earth. Do you understand what I'm talking about here? I wish I could make it even more clear how you're going to have an earth that is prepared for billions upon billions of people. You couldn't just raise them up the way they are and just go from here. You would have to establish different educational centers. There's going to be a new language, isn't there? But there's going to have to be people to teach the people that are raised up the new language. And there are going to have to be people who spoke the language that these people spoke when they were on the earth in our time. There's going to have to be a chance to catch up on the new technology that has been developed. Think of a world that starts right here with the technology we have and then goes 1,000 years. Well, I think there's going to be just wonderful developments, awesome things. But people will have to be taught that. People will have to be taught, they'll have to be brought up to speed on the history of the world. What happened during all of these generations so the generations understand one another? And what happened in the millennial period? They'll have to be taught God's way. And it will take educational centers for that. And there's going to have to be manufacturing plants for there to be clothing for these people to wear. And it's going to take some time, and it's going to take preparation, it's going to take landscaping, it's going to be changes that are going to have to take place here. And I'll suggest to you this, that the preparation for this resurrection will generate such a construction industry and such an incredible economy. The prosperity will be phenomenal to build this, to get things ready, to prepare for this thing that is coming. 1,000 years. It'll probably take hundreds of years to prepare a lot of these things. An awesome undertaking is going to take place. It's going to be great for that reason. But it's going to also be great for this reason. That is this. There is going to be so much of the human suffering that has taken place over the history of this earth that is going to be reversed, and people will be able to be healed. The history of mankind has been a path of blood and suffering and pain as men have warred with one another, as they have tried the get way instead of the serve and give way. They've tried to get more and more from one another until they end up at war and fighting with one another and hurting one another in terrible ways. Most of the world has only been controlled by brutal rulers. And from the earliest times in Egypt, we see that the common people, the everyday people, lived just to serve their God King. And they labored day and night to fulfill his every whim. And that's all their lives were. And then after that, there was the Assyrian rule that was brutal. And the Assyrians used fear. And they were vicious in their rule. And people suffered terribly under their rule. Then there was every other succeeding generation and nation after that. Every empire that came, what did God call them? Beasts. Because they would rip and they would tear and they were like animals. And people have suffered as these leaders would expend the resources of their nation and then expend their young men to use them for this thing called war so that they could try to get a piece of somebody else's territory. And it has been man's proclivity, a history of war and more warfare. From the beginning, throwing of spears, to using swords, to finally developing gunpowder and the Gatling gun, and then finally bombs, and then the A-bomb, until today we have the hydrogen bomb. And it's big business, and big money is spent to make war. A UPI report, I think, said a very interesting, put it a very interesting way. They said it this way. For the past 5,500 years since 3,600 B.C., the world has known only some 300 years of peace. During this huge span in history, the world has seen more than 14,000 large and small wars, which have killed more than 3.5 billion people. There have been more than 1,600 arms races since 650 BC, and only one in 100 of these arms buildups has not ended in war. Yes, most people who ever lived have experienced one form or another of war. And every one of us probably knows people that went to Vietnam or perhaps when were in Korea or so on. But also, war has always been grotesque and cruel, and it has been brutal. I'm going to read just a brief excerpt from an article that was in the Times, and it was about the war in Afghanistan. Please forgive me because it's a little rough, but it was in a public newspaper. And it's the truth of what people live through. The Soviets realized that a maimed child is much more a burden on society than a dead one. They began to drop pretty toys over the ground, and when the little children picked them up, they exploded, blowing off their hands and arms. Soviet soldiers also would leave anti-personnel mines in food bins and other parts of houses where the people had fled. They left mines in mosques where the people went to worship, and they booby-trapped dead bodies to explode when their relatives attempted to move them. Yes, prisoners were subjected to various torture methods, including electric shocks to their genitals and ripping off fingernails and beards, forcing prisoners to drink urine, and women were often raped by the soldiers while their families were forced to look on. It's always been like this. It's no different in Bosnia, no different in Albania, and so on today. It'll probably be no different in Indonesia unless that thing is stopped. And what our generation today has experienced and we've experienced in our lifetime, every generation has experienced the brutality of war. And a time's coming when those people are going to be able to be healed and some of their suffering is going to be eliminated. Let's go over to Matthew 20, if you will. War has gotten bigger and bigger and more powerful and more destructive. And today you and I face a world that is threatened every day with suicidal war. That is atomic, nuclear war, if you will. And I say this, the people in our generation are going to likely experience what I'm going to read to you here from an article in the Time magazine. The firestorm likely to follow a 15-megaton nuclear attack on a strategic air command near Omaha, Nebraska, would dry roast people in the shelter and cremate them as they lived. There would be a fireball at ground level for 20 seconds and a crater 3.25 miles across. The fireball would rise 80,000 feet in less than a minute, and the people 16 miles away would suffer second and third degree burns. 35 miles away, people giving a reflex glance at the explosion would be blinded by retinal burning. And even 12 miles away, the pressure would be enough to shatter windows into lethal slivers of glass and propel them at over 100 miles per hour. This is what mankind has brought war to, his science of war: brutal suffering and pain on others. And mankind has suffered from the effects of this kind of leadership and rule in this world. But during the second resurrection, these people are going to rise and they're going to find a whole different way of living. rulers that will protect them, that will look out for them. Matthew 20. Matthew 20 and verse 25. Jesus called his disciples unto him, and he said, "You know that the princes of the Gentiles exercise dominion over them, and they that are great exercise authority upon them. But it shall not be so among you. But whosoever will be great among you, let him be your minister, your servant, that is. And whoever will be chief among you, let him be your servant. Even as the Son of Man came not to be ministered unto, but to minister and to give his life a ransom for many." And so multiple billions will be raised one day. And it's going to be so wonderful, because instead of finding leaders like the Ayatollah, who would take the, in his war with Iran, would take the children, and he would run the children up over the hill facing the enemy simply to use up the bullets of the Iranians before he would send his own troops over. But that's the kind of leadership that has been in this world. But there's coming a new leadership where they're going to be raised and they're going to see a people who care about them, and leaders who are going to sacrifice their lives for those individuals. They're going to learn a whole different way of life. And to me, this is so meaningful. And that's one of the things that makes this day truly great, because we're going to be a part of that and be able to eliminate so much of the terrible suffering that exists in this world today. My mother raised me alone. She had to divorce my husband when I was about 3 or 4 years old. And she tried to support me all of my life. And we didn't have much money. We had to rent little places in the back houses, parts of other people's houses. It was years before we ever had a car. And eventually we got a car, but we had some tight times. I'll just tell you, there were times when she and I would go out and look under the car seat. We would pull the couch seats out. We'd look for any money we could find to be able to buy food. And I remember one time we had steak for dinner. And I was so impressed with this. And I was telling her how good it was. And she said, "Oh, Butch," she used to call me Butchie. She said, "You haven't tasted anything yet." She said, "They make this meat and they call it prime rib." And she said, it's so incredible. And she said, "It tastes so good and you can just about cut it with a butter knife. It is so tender." And she said, "Someday we're going to have this. Someday we're going to have some prime rib." Well, we lived our life, moved around a lot. We were pretty much remained poor. We were never able to have any prime rib. Then God called me, and I came to his feast. First time I'd ever gone to anything like that. And I'll just tell you, I would never, never, ever think to go spend money on myself. I would never think to take $100 or $200, no, much less thousands of dollars, and spend it on myself. But God had commanded me to do such a thing, and so I said, "I'm going to do what God commanded." And I went to Squaw Valley and met with God's people. And I went out, and guess what I had? Prime rib. Oh, man, this is good. And I thought, this is what my mom was talking about. And I wanted so much to take her to the feast. I wanted so much to give her prime rib. But her health had degenerated pretty badly. And I came back from the feast one time and she died and was buried. But you understand where I'm heading with this. Someday, it's my hope, Jesus Christ is going to call her out of the grave. And she's going to live again. And I'm going to treat her so well for all that she gave me in supporting me those years. And I'm going to give her prime rib. And she's going to have some of the best Cabernet to go with it. It's going to be a wonderful time. But we did eat. We lived decently. We did. I grew up. I was healthy. But many people in this world do not have enough to eat. You know, there's been famine that has ravaged this earth. There's 10 famines mentioned in the Bible alone. And sometimes it gets so severe that people will mix water and dirt just to fill their stomachs. They'll eat bark off of trees. And as I said earlier in another sermon, because of malnutrition, half of the babies in Zambia die. Many people don't live past 30 years old in Haiti. It's a terrible world for literally 500 million people who are undernourished. Right now, as we enjoy this feast, and as we have breakfast, and we have lunch, and we have dinner every day, there are thousands upon thousands of people who are dying. That's right, dying, because they don't have enough to eat. It is this is the world that people live in today. George Borgstrom, food production expert, says one half of all the children alive today never will reach adulthood as a result of starvation. In Ethiopia, you've seen the pictures of these little children and their stomachs begin to distend because they are starving. And it's a tragic thing. And Time magazine ran an article about Ethiopia at one point. I just want to read an excerpt from it, from a personal witness, the journalist. "Although it's not long after dawn," he writes, 26 bodies have already been wrapped in filthy burlap shrouds on the earthen floor. The air is sickly sweet with the smell of decay. All around the house of the dead, in a refugee camp in a small northern Ethiopian town of Bati, more than 25,000 starving people huddled together last week. Some 210 miles away, there was a similar scene of destitution around the 9,000 famished people who crowded into the Quiha camp. When a foreign visitor appeared, the emaciated people took him for a doctor, and they crowded around and they clutched at his trousers and clung to his legs, pleading for help. Half crazed for food, they trampled each other and they knocked down their flimsy shelters in their rush to get some sort of help from the foreigner. Understand that there's a time coming when these Ethiopians are going to be raised, and they are going to crowd around you and clutch at you because you can save them. And you'll have the ability one day to be able to create food the way that Jesus Christ did, and to be able to feed these people who have suffered so terribly on this earth for 6,000 years, whether it's war, whether it's disease, whether it's simply famine. And as I said earlier, the black horse, the pale horse, is going to ride in our future and ride hard. And so there's more of this suffering coming. And so this day is so great because God is going to raise the people who have suffered so terribly, and He's going to give them the right way of life, teach them the right way of life, and they're going to enjoy prosperity, and they're going to enjoy fulfillment, creative fulfillment with one another. They're going to be educated. We're going to find people and leaders that we never knew even existed because they never had a chance to be visible because they died of starvation or some disease. But they'll live then. And so I come to this point too, 1 Corinthians 1, if you will. 1 Corinthians 1. I think this is a worthwhile point. Here's another reason why this day represents a time that is going to be so incredibly great. You see, the people that God's working with in this age are not the greats of the world, are they? Oh, they're the weak of the world. 1 Corinthians 1 and verse 26. 1 Corinthians 1 and verse 26. "For you see your calling, brethren, how that not many wise men after the flesh, not many mighty, not many noble are called. But God has chosen instead the foolish things of this world to confound the wise, and He's chosen the weak things of the world to confound those that are mighty." And so the greats of this world have been blinded by God. Israel, who are a people I admire as a race very much, and the Jews, blinded by God now. But they are just waiting for a time when they will be resurrected. God isn't calling the greats of the world now. But I ask you today to think of all of the greats who ever lived. There's a time coming when God is going to raise those people that were great. He's going to raise the mighty, and He's going to work with them. And what kind of world do you think that is going to produce? The great men, the great women of the Bible, the greats of this world, the Winston Churchills, the Roosevelts, people like Thomas Jefferson, like John Adams. What will it be like when you have people like Nebuchadnezzar resurrected, people with the great minds and incredible talents raised again to now work in cooperation with one another, the great people of this world dedicated to serving and glorifying God? What kind of world are we going to have when the Margaret Thatchers, the Golda Meirs, and Madame Curie, the brilliant ones, the great ones, are all working to serve God? I can't wait to see that kind of culture. When we have men like Michelangelo, who I just admire his sculpture so much, the beauty that his hands were able to create, Leonardo da Vinci, the great inventors, great painters, Monet, the French impressionist, just beautiful work. What about some of the musicians? Handel, Bach, Mozart. You know, a lot of those men, when they lived in their time, they just didn't have a variety of instruments that we have today. They did not have these kinds of things. And I just think it's going to be so amazing for some of those great artists to raise and see an orchestra and see what Yanni is able to do today. But what will they do when they know God? I took a music appreciation class one time over at Pasadena, and the teacher was quite an eccentric, but it was an interesting class. But he made this comment, and I'll submit it to you. He said in ancient times, there were really great composers. He thought of Mozart and Handel and Bach and those men as great composers, and he said, we don't really have the same kind of greatness. We have men that are great, women that are great. It's not the same kind of greatness. He suggested to us this. We looked at music historically, and he said, those who were the ancient ones in history, they wrote their music with a deep desire to glorify God. The people who write music today are doing it to glorify themselves or to make money. And he said, when you have a transcendent reason for the work you do, the work is always going to be better. And so I look forward to a time when the painters, the novelists, the poets, and the great musicians all come up in a resurrection and they learn the truth. And they then work as they're capable with the talents they have to glorify God. Can you imagine what kind of a society, what kind of a culture we're going to have? I think great is an understatement. I really do. But it's going to be a great, great day. The great leaders, the great poets. Then there is the end. The second resurrection is the end. And I want us to realize this. The day we celebrate today is the eighth day. And numbers have meaning. Numbers have meaning. Where most of us are familiar with seven, it means completeness. And we had 7 days of the Feast of Tabernacles. And that reflects that will all be completed at that time, what God is doing then. But then there'll be something new. There'll be something different, the eighth day. And so we're used to the number 12. We understand how that means, what that means, government. There were 12 tribes of Israel, 12 apostles. We see 12 as a multiple that factors into the holy city, its foundations, its gates, all of this where government is going to be there. We see the number 12 is its signature all over that edifice. And so eight, what is it? Well, I think eight has a very important function and meaning. Eight comes after seven. It comes after completion. And the word eight is shiomna. It means surplus, means above, perfect. It means fat or plenteous and indicates superabundance. Now, Bullinger wrote a book on numbers, and he writes this about the number eight. As seven was so called because the seventh day was the day of completion and rest, so eight, as the eighth day, was over and above this perfect completion and was indeed the first of a new series as well as being the eighth. Eight denotes that which is superabundant or satiating. So Noah was the eighth preacher of righteousness. David was the eighth son. We see that circumcision is done on the eighth day. It's a new beginning when the male child is to begin to enter into the covenant. We see that Jesus Christ rose on the end of the seventh day. and he began something new. He functioned now as high priest, and that role was a new beginning. And so I think you can agree with me that 8 represents a new beginning. It's after that which has completed. Let's go to Revelation 20. Revelation 20. There is a time after the 7,000 year when God is going to give all men a chance. There's going to be a final judgment. And everyone found written in the book of life is going to be given a chance at eternal life. And we're going to see something entirely new, a new beginning. Revelation 20, death and the grave are going to be done away. Revelation 20 and verse 11, and then I saw a great white throne, and him that sat on it, from whose face the earth and the heaven fled away, and there was found no place for them. And then I saw the dead, small and great, stand before God, and the books were opened, and another book was opened, which is the book of life. And the dead were judged out of those things which were written in the books according to their works. And the sea gave up all the dead which were in it. Death and hell delivered up the dead which were in them. And they were judged every man according to their works. And death and hell were cast into the lake of fire. This is the second death. And whosoever was not found written in the book of life was cast in to the lake of fire. Yes, it's coming a time when those people who God has given a chance, if they're found written in the book of life, will live, and they will live for all eternity. A wonderful time is coming, but then there will be a new beginning. God is going to have the Father come down. I really believe deeply that there is going to be a massive ceremony at this time. All the children of God gathered, all the angelic host, and singing there, much like the beautiful angelic singing we heard today. It's going to be a time of rejoicing as the Father comes down, and Jesus Christ then turns all things over to Him, and then He Himself submits Himself to the Father, so that God will be all and in all. And then there will be a new heavens and a new earth that will be created. And the sun that we now have will someday go cold, won't it? Entropy is taking place. And so there's going to have to be a new creation, a spiritual creation, and God will create a new universe for us. Revelation 21, Revelation 21 and verse 1. I saw a new heaven and a new earth. For the first heaven and the first earth were passed away, and there was no more sea. And I, John, saw the holy city, New Jerusalem, coming down from God out of heaven, prepared as a bride adorned for her husband. And I heard a great voice out of heaven saying, behold, the tabernacle of God is with men, and He'll dwell with them, and they shall be His people, and God Himself shall be with them, and shall be their God. And God will wipe away all tears from their eyes, and there shall be no more death, neither sorrow nor crying. Neither shall there be any more pain, for the former things have passed away. All the suffering, all the tragedy, all of the pain that 6,000 years of human history has produced will be done away. And then he that sat upon the throne said this, I will make all things new. And he said unto me, write, for these words are true, and they are faithful. Yes, Jesus Christ told us He is going to prepare a place for us. Many mansions, He said. And we have lived out a type of that here at the feast. That is, in this hotel here, we each have a place where we reside. And then we come from that place, and we come down, and we work together, and we produce, and we create. And that is just a simple type of what is going to come. The holy city is going to come down, and it is the bride. And the church is the bride. They are one and the same. They are inextricable. That is what you're called to. The new city, the holy city, is your destiny. That's your destiny, and that time is coming. An eternal city. in which you will have a place to dwell and from which you will work and administer the government of God for all the rest of eternity. And we will live there and be in the presence of God. We'll be awed by the Father. We'll be fascinated by Him. We'll live with Him. We'll work with Him. And we will so joyfully say, "My Father is greater than I." We'll be at His right hand. And it says at His right hand there are pleasures forevermore. But we don't know those pleasures yet. We see the pleasures we have at this feast, don't we? Pretty good, huh? Pretty good. Thank you, Janine. Wonderful. But they're just a type, a symbol of how we're going to live all the rest of eternity with God the Father and Jesus Christ in that holy city. It is a promise from Him. And as it says, these words are true and faithful. You and I can absolutely count on this to be true and that we are a part of it. And so, the last day is the great day. And all it represents is truly wonderful and incredibly great. But the last day, I remind you, is just the beginning of something new. Mr. Armstrong wrote this in what I think is his premier work, The Mystery of the Ages. The very last words of his book say this, and I quote, "How wonderful beyond the ability of words to express is the glory of God and His wonderful purpose actually now in progress." In progress in each one of you. And then he says, "With God's great master plan of 7,000 years finally completed, the mystery of the ages finally revealed, and with the recreating of the vast universe and eternity lying ahead, we come finally to the beginning." End of book. So I say to you today, brethren, the end of God's plan, the glorious end, is only a more glorious new beginning. And so no matter what you and I have to go through, no matter how difficult the trials are, no matter what we have to face in life, I beg you today to remember this. God saves the best for last.
Thank you for listening, and we hope you found the message beneficial. If you would like to know more about the Eternal Church of God, we would like to hear from you. You may contact us at 1-800-723-6108. We also invite you to visit our website at eternalcog.org. Once again, thanks for listening.